glasses. Fuchs dedicated a long essay to fashion in his third volume of the Sittengeschichte. The supplementary volume sums up the train of thought of the essay by listing the decisive elements in fashion. The first element is formed by the interest of class separation. The second is provided by the mode of production of private capitalism, which tries to increase its sales volume by manifold fashion changes. Certainly, one must not forget the erratically stimulating purposes of fashion. Footnote 52, text. The cult of creativity which runs through the whole of Fuchs's work drew fresh nourishment from the psychoanalytic studies. They enriched his originally biologically conception of creativity, though they did not, of course, correct it. Fuchs enthusiastically adopted the doctrine of the erratic origin of the creative impulse. His notion of erraticism, however, remained tied to a drastic, biologically determined sensuality. Page 248. Fuchs avoided, to the degree that it was applicable at all, the theory of complexes and sublimation, which might have modified his moralistic understanding of social and sexual relationships. Fuchs's historical materialism derives things more from the conscious economic interest of the individual than from the class interest which is unconsciously at work within the individual. Similarly, he brings the creative impulse closer to the conscious sensual intention than to the image-creating unconscious. Footnote 53, text. The world of erotic images which Freud made accessible as a symbolic world in his interpretation of dreams expresses itself in Fuchs's work only, where his own inner involvement is most enthusiastic. In such cases, this world fills his writing, even where any explicit mention of it is avoided. This can be seen in the masterful characterization of the graphics of the revolutionary era. Everything is stiff in military. Men do not lie down since the drill square does not tolerate any at ease. Even when people are sitting down, they look as if they want to jump up. Their whole bodies are as full of tension as an arrow on a bowstring. What goes for the lines hold truth for the color. The pictures given a cold and tiny impression over and against the paintings of the Rococo. The color, that to be hard and metallic, if it was to be appropriate for the content of the picture. Footnote 54, text. An informative remark regarding fetishism is more explicit. Here he traces the historical equivalent of fetishism. He says that the increase of shoe and leg fetishism points to the replacement of the priapic cult of the vulva cult. The increase in breast fetishism, on the other hand, points to a regressive development. The cult of a covered foot or leg reflects the dominance of women over men, whereas the cult of breasts indicates the role of woman as an object of pleasure for men. Footnote 55, text. His deepest insights into the symbolic realm Fuchs gained at the hand of Daumier. What he says about Daumier's trees must be considered one of the most auspicious finds of his whole work. In these trees, he recognizes a total unique symbolic form, which expresses Daumier's sense of social responsibility as well as his conviction that it is society's duty to protect the individual. His typical manner of depicting trees shows them always with far-reaching branches, particularly if a person stands or rests under the tree. In such trees, the branches stretch like the arms of a giant and actually seem as they want to reach the infinitive. Thus, the branches come to form an impenetrable roof which keeps danger away from all those who come under their shelter. Footnote 56, text. This beautiful contemplation leads Fuchs to the notion of the maternal preponderance in Daumier's work. Page 249. No other figure has as much life for Fuchs as Daumier, a figure that accompanied him throughout his working life. One might almost say that this made Fuchs into a dialectical thinker. At least, he conceived of Daumier in all the latter's fullness and contradiction. So, Fuchs grasps the maternal element in Daumier's art and paraphrases them rather impressively. He was just as familiar with the other side of the man and his manly and aggressive characteristics. He was right in pointing out the absence of idyllic notion in Daumier's work, not only landscapes, animals, and still lifes, but also erotic motifs and self-portraits are not to be found. What impressed Fuchs most was the element of strife in Daumier's work. Or would it be too daring to look for the origin of Daumier's great character in a question? Daumier seemed to ask himself the following. What would the bourgeois people of my time look like if one were to imagine their struggle for existence as taking place in a palaestra, an arena? Daumier translated the Parisian public and private life into the language of the agone, the athletic tension of the whole body, the muscular movements capture Daumier's highest enthusiasm. That is not contradicted by the fact that there is probably no one who sketched the deepest bodily relaxation as fascinatingly as Daumier. As Fuchs's remarks, Daumier's representation has a deep relationship to sculpture, and thus he carries off the types which his time has to offer. These distorted characters of Olympic contestants in order to exhibit them on pedestals. His studies of judges and lawyers prove particularly favorable for this kind of consideration. The elegiac humor with which Daumier likes to surround the Greek pantheon indicates this inspiration more immediately. Perhaps this is the solution to the riddle which Daumier, the master, represented for Baudelaire, how Daumier's character, with all its force and impact, could remain so free from resentment. Whenever Fuchs speaks of Daumier, all his energies come to life. There is no other subject matter that could draw such divinatory flashes of insight from his knowledgeability. Here the smallest impulse becomes important. A single page so superficially done that it would be a euphemism to call it unfinished suffices for Fuchs to give a deep insight in Daumier's creative mania. The sheet in question represents only the upper part of a head, in which the only expressive parts are the nose and eyes. Insofar as the sketch limits itself to that part, insofar as it only represents the observer, it becomes an indication for Fuchs that here the painter's central interest is at play. For he supposes every painter begins the execution of his paintings in precisely that place in which he is compulsively most interested. Footnote 57, text. Page 250. In Fuchs's work on the painter we find, innumerable of Daumier's characters are busy with the most concentrated looking, be it a looking of the world or a contemplating of specific things, or even a concentrated look on their own interior. Daumier's people practically look with the tips of their noses. Footnote 58, text. Daumier's turned out to be the most auspicious subject matter for Fuchs the scholar. He was also the collector's most lucky find. With just pride, Fuchs mentioned that it was his own initiative and not that of the government which prompted the first collection of Daumier and Gavarni in Germany. In his dislike for museums, he does not stand alone among the great collectors. The brothers Concord preceded him in his dislike and exceeded him in their violence. Public collections may be less problematic from a social point of view and can be scientifically more useful than private ones. Yet they lack the greatest possibilities of private ones. The collector's passion is his divining rod and turns him into a finder of new sources. That holds true for Fuchs. And that it is why he had to feel so opposed to the spirit which dominated the museums under Wilhelm II. These museums were intent on possessing so-called showpieces. Certainly, says Fuchs, today's museums lend toward such a mode of collecting simply for spatial reasons, but that does not change the fact that we thus have quite fragmentary notions of the culture of the past. We see the past in its splendid festive gown and rarely encounter it in its most shabby working clothes. Footnote 59, text. The great collectors distinguish themselves mostly by the originality of their choice of subject matter. There are exceptions. The Concords started less with objects than with the whole that had to ensure the integrity of these objects. They undertook the transfiguration of the interior just as the latter had expired. As a rule, however, collectors have been guided by the objects themselves. The humanists on the threshold of modern history are a great example of this. Their Greek acquisitions and journeys give testimony to the purposefulness with which they collected. Guided by La Bruyère, the figure of the collector was introduced so disadvantageously into literature with Marolles, who served as a model for Damoside. Marolles was the first to recognize the importance of graphics. His collection of 125,000 sheets formed the nucleus of the Cabinet des Estampes. The first great effort of archaeology is Count Kehl's 7-volume catalogue of his collections in the following century. Page 251. Stosch's collection of gems was catalogued by Winckelmann upon commissions by the collector himself. Even where the scientific conception which wanted to materialize itself in such a collection did not last for any length of time, the collection itself sometimes endured more successfully. This is true of the collections of Wallraff and Bouisserie, arising out of the romantic Nazarene theory, which viewed the art of Cologne as the heir of the old Roman art. The founders of the collection formed the basis of Cologne's museum with their German paintings of the Middle Ages. Fuchs had to be placed in this line of great and systematic collectors who were resolutely intent on a single subject matter. It is his idea to give back to the work of art its existence within the society from which it had been cut off. The work of art had been detached from society to such a degree that the place in which the collector found it had become the art market. There, the work of art endured, shrunk into a commodity, and found itself equally as removed from its creators as from those who were able to understand it. The master's name is the fetish of the art market. From a historical point of view, Fuchs's greatest achievement may be his having cleared the way for art history to be freed from the fetish of the